So, welcome to
A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast.
That's Michael Bates.
I am, and that's Dave Douglas.
And we're talking with Lenny Pickett today, who is an incredible composer, saxophonist, and also for many years musical director at Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I'm sad I missed this one. This is a conversation that happened between Lenny and Dave.
And I went up to 30 Rock where they taped the show and talked to Lenny. It was a lot of fun.
Good to see you.
You too.
You've been living downtown Manhattan forever, right?
Let's see, since 1981, yeah, in Tribeca.
Been now, you were with Tower of Power when you moved here, or you were already finished with
that? Had stopped. I had officially left the group, but they sort of kept me going a little bit. I went out on a tour with them. Let's see, I went out and did a live, direct-to-disc album with them that following summer. And then I did a tour with the horn section with this group Heart, the girls. Yeah,
I remember Heart.
Yeah, toured with them a little bit, and did some playing with them over the summer. I was sort of having a little trouble getting enough work when I first moved to the city, just getting people to know who I was and whatnot.
Wow.
So you know, it takes a minute to integrate into it. I wanted to be a studio musician.
I guess the thing that I want to makes me really curious is, like, you were already such a supernatural saxophone player at that. I mean, to get that gig with Tower of Power, you had to have that phenomenal altissimo register and the whole thing hooked up at the age of 17, 18.
I was 18. Yeah, I'd been, you know, I dropped out of school when I was 14. And just played the saxophone all the time. I was not a very social person. I was, you know, spent a lot of time in the practice room, you know, and was comfortable with that. It was the answer for everything else in my life was to, you know, hang out in the practice room.
And just play saxophone,
play the saxophone
all the time.
All the time. And so I, you know, that what happens when you... To anybody listening, if you want to get good at something, do it a lot, you know.
And it's the famous 10,000 hours.
Exactly, thing. And it works. So I just spent a lot of time, yeah, but, highly motivated, and you know.
Yeah, but you also, I mean, that altissimo thing doesn't just happen for people. Well, you know, you must have had a system.
I was a clarinet player. See, that was my first instrument, and as a clarinet player, I knew the instrument didn't stop. But like, all right, the saxophone. The way that it's taught, for the most part, it's taught you play the fundamental pitch, and you play the notes that start an octave higher than that, and that's it. You know, a traditional way of teaching the saxophone. So you have like two, like on trumpet, that would be like you playing the pedal tones and then the next register, and that's as far as you go with it. Mm-hmm. And the clarinet doesn't do that. It immediately goes to the third harmonic, and then the fourth, and then even the fifth. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, this is crazy. Why does my fingering chart stop here? You know, why does it? You know. And I didn't have any saxophone lessons, so I just was experimenting. I didn't have a saxophone teacher. I had a couple of clarinet teachers. You know, saxophone is like such a more popular thing to do than being a clarinet player. I mean, my name was Leonard, and I played the clarinet, and it was like, you know, this was not a way to get...
This was not, in Berkeley, that was not like the hit.
No, that wasn't going to get you anywhere. And somebody loaned me their alto one day, and I was playing it outside, and I was like, this thing is loud, and this is awesome, and I like this. And,
oh, wow.
You know, it's like megaphone compared to the clarinet. You know, it's like, this is really something.
But so. You teach saxophone now, too, mm-hmm. So at NYU and probably other places.
Yeah, privately, yeah.
Yeah, and that must be a really powerful... lesson to get them going on those overtones.
Yeah, well, you know, it's it just made more sense that this saxophone would continue, you know, that, and so I was trying clarinet techniques on the saxophone, and that sort of worked.
Right.
In the beginning, I played the I played the saxophone really wrong. I played like the second register. I started with notes with fingerings that were too long for what you normally, you know, I was
right.
I didn't really know until I got a fingering chart what was going on, and I was experimenting. And so by the time I actually got around to getting a book and, you know, all those things, I had already developed some things on the instrument that were just accidental based on my experiments. And I was playing altissimo before I even got a fingering chart. I didn't
really,
and it wasn't, also, I grew up listening to R&B, and I'd heard King Curtis and Junior Walker and other stuff, and those were the current exponents of the sort of
blues saxophone,
the people who are the descendants of Louis Jordan and et cetera, Illinois Jacquet, et cetera, you know, and that school of saxophone playing, which, you know, was married to swing bands, actually, in its day, you know, popular saxophone playing, and I knew that was possible because I'd heard those artists too. So I was, you know, just interested in doing that. Plus, I wanted to sound contemporary. You know, there was a little soul band in my neighborhood. I was living on West Berkeley, sort of other side of the tracks, Berkeley, and there was a local band that I could get into if I could play shotgun, you know. So I learned how to do some of that stuff, and it was an entree
into that. And it became soul and R&B and blues.
But my stepfather was a jazz trumpet player, and he was in the penitentiary 15 years.
The band penitentiary?
No, Folsom Prison and Soledad and a couple other California prisons. He was an armed robber, and there's a big jazz scene, and there was at least in the 60s and the late 50s, and probably still is. And he had been a trumpet player before when he was a kid. Now he finds himself in prison, and he's just practiced all the time, and he got really good bebop player, had a fantastic record collection because he got paroled a couple of times and would use whatever money he had to buy records. So I was growing up, I had like that huge Blue Note catalog and all the early Verve stuff, and he had just a fantastic collection of records. And he would sit at the piano and play modal. He'd like, D minor, and I'd play along, and he was playing me all these records and exposing me to that. My mother was a jazz fan too, so I was sort of surrounded by lots of musical influences. So she listened to K Jazz on the radio, which was the local radio station, jazz station, and K Soul and KDIA and all that.
But all those influences became a big part of everything that you do,
purely by osmosis. I wasn't it wasn't a intended thing. It was just environmental experience. I got interested in electronics when I was in my early 20s, and I met Pat Gleason, who was the synthesist on Sextant and Crossings and
Herbie Hancock
stuff.
Synthesist.
And when he was doing the more, he was his synthesist, and we became really good friends. And he helped me put together a studio, and I built a classic analog electronic music studio.
Like Moog or Buchla?
I used an EMU, which is same kind of concept, a little bit cleaner technology, a little higher better signal to noise ratio, more stable oscillators. It was like a perfected version of Moogs and
is that
harps.
What you're still using?
I have that still. I still use it. I use a lot of digital stuff now. I mean, I got interested in computer music kind of early on. Pat had studied with John Chowning at Stanford.
Stanford, yeah.
And was interested in that. And I got turned on to that. And I started subscribing to Computer Music Journal and sort of following along with that about the time that whole business started.
Yeah.
And I pursued it. I mean, every time I was in a town where there was a digital music program, I would visit them and look at their lab and try to figure out. I kept like a log of where these places were. So if I was in, you know, I drop in on the electronic music studios and see what was happening.
This track where you're creating a sonic bed for Allen Ginsberg,
mm-hmm.
And is that from a record then?
Or yeah, it was a call. Let's see, The Lion for Real is the name of the album,
right?
And it was
Hal Willner produced,
right. Hal gave me the reading, and let me take it home and compose around it. I noticed that Alan read in very even tempo and meter, you know, and so I made a click track. Found his tempo, made a click track, and then I put laid his voice up against the track, and I put spaces in between the different stanzas. But his reading was so amazingly precise that it was possible to have music go along with it, you know, and feel like he was reading to the music, you know, which it was really fun. And he was
that's an amazing track to listen to. Also, especially now knowing, which I didn't know, that you got the recording of his voice and
closed
around it.
If money made the mind more sane, or money mellowed in the bowel the hunger beyond hunger's pain, or money choked the mortal growl and made the groaner grin again, or did the laughing lamb embolden to loll where has the lion lain, I'd go make money and be golden. Nor sex will salve the sickened soul which has its holy goal an hour, holds to heart the golden pole, but cannot save the silver shower, nor heal the sorry parts to hold. Love is creeping undercover where it hides its sleepy dole, else I were like any lover. At sea, others slave upon a stone. Engines are not eyes to me. Inside buildings I see bone. Some from city to city flee. Famous labors make them lie. I cheat on that machinery.
Alan was an amazing guy. He had like a real musical sensibility. He always talked about the quality of the reading voice and how it was in his chest, and he was really conscious of the sound he was making, you know, and the rhythm was, you know, this is an older poem, not terribly recent, and it was an earlier style of writing for him, but I really liked the way it flowed, and Hal let me listen to a few things, and I really liked that piece.
You know, it's interesting because you're, I mean, okay, there's nothing new about this idea of the dichotomy between high art, high music, and low music, right? Mm-hmm. Popular music, serious music, whatever you want to call it. And it seems to me, in looking at some of the things that we've been talking about, you know, that you're sort of at the inception of this whole crux of the discussion in our culture, that this has been going on for you for a long time, living in... maybe not even both worlds. Maybe there's no difference.
I never...
But the perception of it...
Yeah. I never discerned a difference. You know, to me, it was... I mean, I was exposed to the idea that there was a difference. But I grew up with people that were much less judgmental about those things. And I mean, remember, you know, Berkeley in the 60s was a moment of great... foment and it was a really interesting moment. It was probably
changing ideas
and the idea of things mixing and blending and being two things at once was quite common. Sly Stone was a DJ on Kasel. And then he was producing the Beau Brummels, but he was a soul musician. But he was, you know.
Did you ever feel this as a fight that you had to fight?
Only when people brought it to me later on. I don't. You know, people would bring it up as an issue of contention. But initially, no. I felt quite comfortable. Crossing back and forth. It wasn't really.
Do you feel like a group like Borneo Horns? It's concert music and it's popular music. I mean, that if anything.
Right.
That's the epitome of this.
Well, it was there's a lot of different ways of talking about that. Classical music was often based on popular song. Up until the early part of the 20th century, yeah. The audience for classical music was very popular. Mozart audiences sat on it was a festival seating. You had a bottle of wine. You had a picnic. You listened to the opera.
You don't have to convince me.
You know, jazz was popular music. It was music you went out to dance to. It wasn't music you sat on your hands to. It was like you went in jitterbug and did the thing. You know, it was like this. It's a bit of an artificial, I think, maybe even an academic standpoint to sort of maybe insulate people from criticism, perhaps, or to make it so that their world is special and set apart, so that other people can't maybe make critical judgment on it, because they are now the soothsayers, the people who are able to say what goes on.
Talking about writers and the media.
The academy tends to do this, because I teach now and I see what happens inside a university. You have. There's a certain insularity that takes place in that. And I think, like, serial music was born with a really interesting idea, and Wozzeck is a fantastic opera, amazing thing. But what happened when it got captured by the United States, academic environment, it turned into a math problem. And it became less a soulful thing that was trying to expand the nature of harmony in the Second Viennese School to being something that was a captive of arithmetic. And I don't know that, and that was only when the Academy took hold of it. And the same thing happened in jazz. When you got hold of it, it suddenly solidified around, late 40s, early 50s bebop, and that became the gospel, and that became the what gets taught inside a jazz academy, as opposed to what happened in the real life. Like Ron Carter didn't go to jazz school, Herbie Hancock didn't go to jazz school, Wayne Shorter didn't go to jazz school, Miles Davis didn't go to jazz school, that whole group didn't go to jazz school, Tony Williams didn't go to jazz school. But they were all jazz musicians, and Miles was doing things that were like extraordinary. And very much outside of the box, And by the time you hit Bitches Brew, he was embracing all of culture.
But aside from jazz, your music is also living in the concert music world.
Well, I lived in both worlds. When you're an 8-year-old kid, you're not going, this is good, that's bad.
Right.
You're just going, what do I like?
So when you're writing concert music, you sent me this example, Radio Blues Mystery, the chamber piece.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you answered my question already as to whether you're thinking about the dichotomy of concert music and popular music.
I do, and I like them both so much, so I don't feel like ostracizing either one of them.
But I hear Millot and maybe Stravinsky.
Yeah, a little Poulenc, a little... Yeah.
Copland.
Yeah, sure.
Even Nancarrow?
Yes. I used to go on the road with a cassette player and a pair of headphones, and those little Shermer, you know, pocket scores. You know, I'd take them.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
So I'd record, I'd take my LP, and I'd put, like, the Rite of Spring or, you know, Firebird or something
bring
on
the
that.
Score.
Bring along the score, and long bus rides with
and
power.
And this is on the band bus, and nobody...
Yeah, bound bus.
Did they call you the professor?
No, they... I wasn't... I you know, there was the smoking section in the back
right.
where they played cards and stuff like that. And, you know, I had... I just... I didn't smoke, and I didn't play cards, so I'd, like, hang out in the front.
So you listened to Stravinsky.
And
well,
I and I
course,
read my pocket score and I would study it. I go, oh, that's an interesting thing to do with a clarinet, you know,
right.
Fascinating, you know, yeah. and I had no formal instruction at all.
Did you feel of a piece with the minimalist movement in any
In a
sense?
Way, in a way. I mean, I listened to that music, and I liked it. I really liked music for, what's the one, the Steve Reich, the 18 Musicians.
18 Musicians,
I love that
yeah.
piece. And the early Philip Glass stuff, I was really, mm-hmm. I liked It's Gonna Rain. I thought that was
mm-hmm.
pretty interesting. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think some of those people came about their music, and I know Steve Reich from just reading about him that he also experimented with tape quite a bit, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
my composing came out of working with the with that
working with tape.
Interesting tape,
yeah.
you know, method of, but maybe less. I mean, there was some looping and things like that, but a lot more just like what can you do with a click track and what can you do with an edit. You know, how can you edit a piece?
I mean, in some sense, do you feel like your work is still coming from that place?
Absolutely, yeah.
So
yeah.
that everything you write for here and...
Well, when I started working at Saturday Night Live,
mm-hmm.
they asked me if I wrote charts. And I'd written some this Borneo Horn stuff, but I hadn't done any charts for like a whole band like this.
Right.
But I just said yes. You know, did I write charts? I said yes. So... The
good answer.
Yes.
Was this Lauren asking?
No, it was Howard Shore asking.
I see.
And so Howard asked me, and I said, sure, of course I do. And so they gave me a cassette and said, you know, bring back transcriptions of these tomorrow. And I stayed up all night, and I had some score paper, of course, at
yeah.
home. And I wrote some things, and I brought them in. I showed them to the copyist, and he was like holding the paper. Well, exactly. What did you mean by this? He said, this is not how you do this. You do a coma sopra over here. You circle this, and you draw a line through that, and then you do this. And so I learned like how to do like commercial scoring techniques.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to do like film score, or how to work with. I learned it backwards. I learned it from the copyist, you know, like the
right.
conventions of how to do this, you
yeah.
know. So I shifted
it's
gears
a very
little.
Helpful way to learn it, actually.
Totally. Copyists have been my saving grace,
yeah.
you know. You know, they tell me, oh, you can't, that's
yeah.
not the way you do that, you know.
and
the best book on orchestration is this book by, what's his name, Gardner Reed. That's
oh,
called
yeah.
Music Notation. To me, that's the best book on orchestration because it's like, if you approach it from a notational side, you see, well, what are the conventions and what's possible,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, I have all these books, of course, and orchestration books and stuff, and I learned, and once I had to start writing for lots of different instruments, I had to sort of figure out, like, all right, what are the ranges?
Go instrument by instrument.
Yeah, what are the methodologies?
Yeah.
How do you write for string quartet? What's
right.
the... You know, what is bowing? What's luray? What's detaché? What is all these? What do these things mean? How does it sound? Get a recording, see the score, listen to it, look at the notation.
Right.
You know, and mm-hmm. to me, that's the the art of being an orchestrator is, I mean, Duke Ellington did it the best of anybody. Mm-hmm. It's like he was writing for individuals, you know. And I'm so fortunate now. I work in a group with, you know, Steve Turre and Earl Gardner and Alex Foster and Ron Blake. I mean, it's fantastic.
James Genus.
You know, it's like I can,
and Sean Pelton.
And this, our new piano player, Tufas Zimbabwe, who's an amazing sight reader. And like, so you see what's their playing like, you know, what notes does Steve like to play, you know, where on the horn does this work best for people, like right. What's his pedal tone like, you know. And you hear the sound coming back, and that's reinforcing the idea of what you can do
right
when you write for the things that work the best for right. those players.
Where are the fat notes?
Yeah. What's James going to do if I write, you know, eighth notes for him? Well, you know, what right. will he actually play? You know, it's like, you know, if I leave some open space, what'll happen there? You know.
Right.
You know, and
so, you've been here now almost 20 years.
I've been writing for these guys for almost 30 years.
Saturday Night Live. You started writing.
And I started being an arranger in '85. So so 29 years now.
Wow. You said how many pieces have you created for the band?
Well, I don't know. Exactly. There's 850 titles in the book. Done probably 2/3 of those. You know.
Wow. And so that's a library that you can cycle through week to week.
Right, and some of it's transcription and some of it's original. And yeah, I have enough now that I can play, not repeat songs for quite a long time, you know, which is good.
I was looking at the, you had a printed out rundown of all the music from the show. Mm-hmm. And after one of the songs, it said, you know, blah, 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 monologue, 69 bars. And
right.
It's like, well, why does it, is that because you're counting bars? And he said, well, no, I couldn't think of another title for it. It was 69 bars long.
I wrote 26 pieces called, you know, you see on the rundown, it says band shot.
Yeah.
I just wrote band shot music. And then right. I gave it a letter. So I have Bandshot Music A through Z that were titles.
Come up with a new alphabet. Double A, double B.
Yeah, exactly. ran out of titles.
Are great pieces. I mean, do you ever play them outside the show? Or?
A little bit.
These are the pieces that you hear right before the ad or right when the show comes back.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit. I mean, I teach them. I use them as teaching materials at NYU.
Uh-huh.
They make fantastic teaching materials. So some of them are written very experimentally. Like, you know, early on, before I started to understand what was appropriate for the show through experimentation. Like, what do people respond to, you know? Like, because what you're trying to do is, we're sort of like the rodeo clowns at the rodeo, you know? Something happens, goes haywire, the cowboy gets hurt, audience needs to be entertained, you know? So the clowns run out there, they distract the bull, and they entertain the audience for a while, you know? Well, they go into commercial here, and that's a 3.5-minute gap where you fall into a hole if you're an audience member.
Right.
So I need to try to keep them entertained. So I'm conscious of what people are experiencing by their response, you know? They're breathing with us and living with us, and so you can kind of feel the audience, and I've been trying to craft the music so that it has the shape and the form and the ingredients that connect with the people that are there. And you got to remember, they come from every part of the country. They sent away for their tickets 8 months ago.
Right.
They made their trip to New York around their tickets at SNL. It's not a uniform audience by any means. So how do you get across this demographic of unknown? And it ends up being very much about moment and gesture and...
But it's also, you know, it becomes an identifier for the show. I mean, you really... Because it's also going out on air, on television, and so it's this thing that frames the show, and it creates a vibe.
It's a little bit like those cartoons that were around the edges of
Mad Magazine, right?
Sort of like that.
It's a little better than that.
But Howard had this idea from the beginning that the music would be sort of located in rhythm and blues, and basically as a sort of starting point, and because that's sort of a lingua franca. It's like a common language for the Americans and in the...
Well, it's also because it's instrumental music, you know, and then it has that really soulful, expressive quality to
it. It works, you know. It's obviously, you hear it in hip-hop, you hear it in contemporary pop music. It hasn't gone anywhere. It's like, it's stuck around. It's like, to me, it's jazz. I like to integrate the contemporary. To me, the project you and I did with Kenny Werner, mm-hmm. that thing I thought was like an interesting place for like improvised music and scored music sort of to move into, where you can integrate with the electronics a little bit, you know, and I'd like to, you know, jazz has enveloped so many other things. It would be nice to see it finally really take that in. And I mean, you know, live electronics is one thing, but trying to figure out how to engage digital technology.
Definitely.
It's embraced bossa nova.
It's a big part of the field, you know, now, I think.
Totally, yeah. It's embraced everything, every other kind of music. You know, why shouldn't it embrace that as well, you know?
So what's the name of that closing theme that you guys play?
That's Howard's piece. He calls it a concerto in A minor or something like that.
When did he write that?
He wrote it in 1975 when the show started. You know,
Concerto in A minor.
Or maybe it's A major.
I thought that
was
Concerto in Robert A. Schumann.
He just had a name for it. You know. So.
Sound amazing on it every week.
You. It's beautiful. You have a sort of transcendent, like hopefully. Sort of gathering people, you know. It's mm-hmm. Music is such a powerful thing that way. It transcends language. You can't say what it is or why you're feeling a certain way or what, and you can't put words to it very easily. But when it works in a certain kind of way, when it's a way of gathering people together, it's such an important thing, you know, sort of includes it's us as a tribe.
Worth spending all those years alone in the practice room.
Totally.
So that you could gather all these people together.
Well, you know, to me, music was like, was the answer, you know. It was like, I there were probably a lot of things I would have liked to express, but had no way to do it. Mm. But being an instrumentalist, you could say things emotionally that you would have a very difficult time putting words to, you know. But it's always felt that way to me. It's always been a way of communication, you know. And I don't like putting a fine point on it, making it like, well, I'm saying this or I'm saying that. But I know that I'm expressing something, and that sense of connection to the audience and to the listener is so incredibly valuable, you know.
Wow, that's great. Lenny, thank you so much for talking
with me.
My pleasure.
It was fun. Yeah.
So
look forward to hearing it.
We'll leave it there. We'll wrap it up here at Rockefeller Center. And
yeah.
Thanks for having me up.
And, yeah, totally. Yeah. Good to
see you
again.
And hear you again soon.
Yeah, good to see you.
Thanks. So that was my interview with Lenny Pickett. Great guy.
Yeah.
Amazing musician.
I love that story. The Tower of Power on the bus story.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? That's an incredible image of somebody having their Stravinsky pocket scores on the bus with Tower of Power in the 70s.
Who'd have thunk it?
Drummond?
Hey, what's up?
How you doing, man?
How are things?
Things are good. I was in the city yesterday.
Yeah?
And the car we were in was towed, so it was fun.
Why were you in the city? Were you going to a show?
Yeah, I went to see Tom Harrell.
Oh, nice.
How was it?
It was really great.
Yeah? Did you get the car back?
Yeah, we got the car back. The owner of the car is making up. Split the ticket, and it makes sense because we were all reading the signs. We're like, oh no, let's just find a park here.
That's a serious ticket. That's like $400.
$300 something. Hopefully, split five ways, so it shouldn't be that bad. But
well, that sounds like a real good fun night in the city.
Oh, it was very fun.
So what are you listening to these days aside from Tom Harrell?
Aside from Tom Harrell, I went to see Al Foster.
Oh, yeah?
I went to see Al Foster, and that was awesome. Mm-hmm. And also Animals as Leaders, another band that I always talk about.
Who?
Animals as Leaders.
Uh-huh.
They're two incredible guitarists, Javier Reyes and Atos Nabati. Came out with a new album recently, and I've been listening to that a lot.
Wow.
That sounds cool. Thanks for the tip. We'll check it out.
Yeah, definitely.
That's our episode for today. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Lenny Pickett. And go ahead and get other episodes of our podcast at greenleafmusic.com or at iTunes.
And also please leave a review. Let us know what you think. And like us on the iTunes page. That gets the word out to different people.
And we should, do we have a Facebook page for the podcast?
We do not.
Okay, so we should probably do that.
Okay, we're getting on that.
We're so, like, 2013. But it's also interesting that we've had some nice emails and some nice reviews.
Yeah.
And then we put out this offer that if you write an extraordinarily witty review or send us a witty email, that there's like free stuff that will come your way, and it hasn't really.
And there have been some great reviews, and thank you for those. But we'd like people to really step it up and maybe a little more inventive. Yeah, wouldn't you say?
He said it.
I said it. Thanks for listening.